T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Molly and Hall.
We're trying to wake Chicago up.
Live at 5 on 670 The Score.
And here they come.
When you think about the Cubs and the White Sox, they're very interesting teams because they're kind of on opposite sides of what we talk about. When you talk about the teams that are favored here in this shortened 60-game sprint, you say, well, if you have veteran teams, if you got guys that have been together, that's a huge advantage. And then you say, wow, if you got young guys that are probably fit as a fiddle and they're ready to go because they got that youthful exuberance, they're going to be able to hit the ground running.
The White Sox probably do have a higher ceiling just because of the young players and the potential and just the athletic skill set that they have and the pitching depth that they could have if they stay healthy, and everything's predicated on that. You could look at the White Sox and say they are better equipped because inexperience will not factor in as much because it's just going to be a test of ability. On the other hand, you could, if you're a Cubs fan, say 60 games is going to heighten the intensity of every one of them and make every one mean more than they typically do. And in that environment, you might have more intensity. It might have more of a playoff feel.
Mike Mulligan and David Hall.
Good morning, guy over there.
Mornings on The Score.
You need to just put this thing out of reach. You need to win 40-something games. Just go ahead and feel free to just start winning early and keep winning. If you're a manager, how hard are you willing to push, given the fact that this is a sprint and not a marathon, as you usually see?
I wouldn't worry about pacing anybody. That's the thing. You know, you don't have to worry about that as much. On the other hand, though, as you point out, and I think this is the bigger thing, if a guy is in a slump, you can't be patient.
Mully Hall.
I'm so fired up.
Here we go.
Mully and Hall, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. It's here. It's finally here. It's Friday.
What Friday. Do you think,
David? Friday.
Good morning, Mully.
How are you, my friend?
Happy Friday. I am doing fine. Had a good Thursday. Looking forward to the weekend. And yeah, we are here to talk about baseball. We've got it coming in. I'm waiting for the schedule like everybody. I wonder when we will get the first look at that.
Well, I think it's fascinating that MLB told clubs that they're permitted to schedule up to 3 exhibition games before the end of spring training, the second spring training. And if a club is not located near any potential opponents, it can schedule games against its initial regular season opponents in days leading up to opening day. They're not going to let scouts attend any of the taxi squad workouts or the inner squad games, and MLB hasn't decided whether to allow in-person scouting at any point this season, and especially in the preseason. But the full 60-game schedule will be out early next week, and we can chew over how they line up.
That's got to leak before that, though, doesn't it?
You would think. It usually does. Yeah, I think over the weekend we'll probably get a pretty good feel, unless they're scrambling to put it together. Oh, wait, what? A schedule? No one told me.
All sorts of complications could, you know, be in store. You think that's got to be a difficult thing to try to streamline, especially with, you know, all of these things that you have to factor in. And I would not want to be on that committee, like, okay, you know, who wants to do the schedule? You know, not me. It's got to be complicated. I think that I think that the preseason of three games is probably fair. I'm going to be curious to see what the White Sox do with their overflow on their roster. I think with the Cubs, we heard yesterday that South Bend makes a lot of sense for them because it's an affiliate. It's close. You'll see a lot of prospects, probably guys who don't make, you know, I think that the 20 or so players on the 60 will end up being somewhere else. What will the Sox do? Where will they go to kind of stay sharp? I don't know that they've got some options. They've got some local options, but I don't think they've got one decided upon yet.
UIC, wasn't that one that has been mentioned quite often?
Makes sense.
Someone tweeted out Chicago State dropped baseball, right? So they got a field sitting there. I don't know if...
That's a sad story.
It is a sad story. It's really rough. It's a rough one for anybody connected to it.
Yeah, Dion Miller from ABC7 was on with Lawrence yesterday, and she had the story the night before just about what is going to happen. And, Mully, I mean, Chicago State is a local example, and you feel for those kids whose programs now, you know, they are eliminated. But that's going on all over the country. And when you see how many sports at the college level are just going to be scrapped because of what's going on, it's like all these opportunities and all these careers come to an abrupt end. It's sad.
Yeah, it's difficult. You know, you play a minor sport and you know where you stand in the hierarchy and everything, and everybody's got a chip on their shoulder about not getting this or getting that. But to lose all scholarships, to lose all of your ability to play while you're at a school. I mean, I'm going to transfer for my final year. Really? I mean, it's just a difficult one. It's really a hard one to figure out. It's difficult to you know, I remember being in school and going to Rome for the, you know, second semester of my senior year. And when I got back, or my junior year, I got back from my last year. It felt like five classes had graduated somehow. So many people I knew were gone from campus, and it was almost shocking to think about. It was almost like two or, you know, more classes had graduated, and I, you know, knew guys that were younger than me a year or two, but my senior year was bizarre because I had been away for the second semester of my junior year.
Yeah, and you look at all the people that make decisions about colleges, and I know you went through that with your daughter who's going to be a freshman next fall, and I went through that with my son, and you factor in, you know, the sports program in the case of if you're going to play a sport in college. You know, my son's a hockey player at Butler, and, you know, Butler hockey is not what Butler basketball is, and certainly other minor sports even. But you see people and students who are going to make those decisions with that in mind. And now when you have the rug pulled out from under you, and, you know, people who have, you know, whether it's, you see all across the country, you know, elimination of these programs, that changes the dynamic for the college, and it changes the, you know, everything about it. It's a tough lesson to learn, and it's adversity you're going to have to deal with, and it could be a lot worse. But it's sad because, you know, when we talk about sports and the return of sports, we focus so much on the professional aspect in town. But when you see situations like Chicago State, it's a reminder of just, you know, in everybody's little world, that the importance of a sport can be, you know, Chicago State baseball is important to the people who can't play Chicago State baseball anymore. You know,
that's right. Yeah, yeah. And again, it you think about a school like that. They're kind of looking locally at different players, and that is another option for some kids that is taken away from them, which is just not good. So, what are you going to do? It's part of a significantly larger issue, and we'll see how it goes. What did you think about the idea that the Cubs, Crane Kenny on the Score yesterday, the Cubs optimistic that fans are going to be allowed inside Wrigley Field at the reduced capacity? About 8,000 people might be able to go to games. The rooftops will indeed be open. Again, I would imagine reduced capacity. The White Sox are petitioning to be able to play with a reduced capacity. So, you know, it's a possibility that we will have some semblance of fans in stadiums this year.
Well, there's been chatter of that all week. I think Danny Parkins talked about the White Sox making those plans, and we heard yesterday from Crane Kenny. Of course they are. I mean, you would think that you're going to try to get as many people through the gates and as many paying customers as possible, and that, to me, falls under the category of due diligence. Now, in Chicago, unlike some other municipalities, Chicago, you can't really green light that yet because the mayor has yet to ease those restrictions. That in the state of Illinois, those have been eased, but that's not in the city of Chicago.
Right.
So there's a lot of, you know, hurdles that are still have to be cleared, but it's a good sign. I mean, and I think that we heard Crane Kenny on with Dan Bernstein yesterday. You know, it is 8,000 people can make a little bit of noise and create a little bit of an atmosphere at both ballparks, more so than an empty stadium when you're kind of manufacturing a lot of the atmosphere, if you will. So I think that's a good sign. It gives people something to look forward to. I don't know how I would feel personally about going to a game with 8,000 people. I let's wait and see when that happens and how, what the situation is at that point. But it's encouraging to hear those kind of projections, sure.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating to think about it all the way around. We'll get into it a little bit, but I would imagine that there's a lot of people that would be interested if it were indeed safe. And apparently there's going to be walk-up music for players, and there's going to be the PA system and all that stuff, so that's planned as normal.
That was a little surprising, but I understand it because you've got to create – and I thought Crane did a nice job of reminding everybody, you know, there's an element of concern about creating that atmosphere for players and making them feel comfortable and creating as much a sense of normalcy as possible, because they're going to notice, and obviously you want them to, you know, have the routine and the ritual, and they're creatures of habit. And it's going to be odd to play in a stadium day after day after day without anybody in it if that's the case. So, yeah, the Cubs are going to do all that they can to kind of duplicate that, what it felt like, what it normally feels like, down to – I don't know what they're going to do with the seventh-inning stretch. I don't think they're planning to bring people into the booth to sing, but they might do something like that on the TV broadcast, it sounded like.
And it was interesting because Rick Hahn zoomed with the media yesterday, said that that no player or coach from the White Sox had expressed a desire to opt out of the season at this point. And he had some interesting things to say. He's in favor of the new rule changes, including having the runner start on second base in extra innings. That he said, why not do something different? Why not experiment? And, you know, they did this in the minor leagues, obviously. And I think games went from like 30% that would end in the ninth inning to 70% when you added the runner on second. So maybe there is an element of good to this in terms of limiting the time of these games when you're playing so many in such an abbreviated schedule.
I think people might end up liking it. I think because it's just you start an inning with already a heightened sense of drama. So you have to kind of pay attention from the first pitch. And not that there isn't necessarily, but this increases it. It doesn't sound like Rick Renteria liked it as much as Rick Hahn might have, because the traditionalist in Renteria sounded like he was maybe going to just grudgingly accept the circumstances, but it didn't sound like he was necessarily in favor of it. You understand that, but I kind of am curious to just see how it unfolds, and I'm keeping an open mind because this is one of those seasons where you've got to, you know, it's going to be, you have to be open to everything that's going to happen because of the irregularity of it.
I saw United a couple days ago return to Old Trafford for the first time since they returned to play, and they had a kind of, you know, United are the Red Devils. They had this red covering around the seats with some advertising on it. And then they, instead of empty seats, they had like pictures of fans, like in like a giant mural that stretched up over the to kind of cover the seats. I got to tell you, and they piped in some music. The game started and they didn't pipe in any crowd noise or anything. And then all of a sudden it came on. They actually had a thing on the broadcast that apologized that they couldn't run it without the crowd noise. And I'm like, give me the crowd noise. Give me a little atmosphere. I don't know how the players feel about it, but at least it didn't feel like an empty stadium. It didn't look like that on television, which is really kind of what you're after. Just kind of you're putting on a TV show.
Did you see what the Giants are doing? Did you see what the Giants are sponsoring a fan cutout program where they're giving season ticket holders the opportunity to have a cardboard cutout image of themselves and place them into the seats where they would typically sit? Or actually, it's an image of themselves placed onto the cutout, which will be displayed during home games. And they're charging then for non-season ticket holders $99 for the option of having a cutout image displayed in the stands. So you are virtually at every game, virtually eating, drinking, whatever you want, and virtually cheering along with the Giants. Isn't that bizarre?
It's really funny. I don't know. Okay, here's the thing. So the first game they played was against Spurs, and it was at Spurs. And they put jerseys of the fans that had died on the seats. So it was an empty stadium except for these seats that were covered with jerseys honoring the fans that had passed away, the season ticket holders. You know, mainly because of the virus. And it was chilling. It wasn't like pleasant. It was just kind of like, oh my God, that whole section is gone. You know, we've lost six people over here. It didn't move me like that.
That's not the vibe you're looking for.
No,
it?
No, it's not. But I mean, it's a nice tribute, but it's rough. I just don't know that I want some guy's cardboard image when I look up and this guy's like screaming angrily at me. What did I do?
I think you could do things for the television broadcast that would make it, you know, less jarring to see an empty stadium. You could do all sorts of things with, you know, in terms of imposing fans into the stands if you wanted to do something like that. But the actual, I think it would be kind of eerie to have. I think it's odd to look at the KBO. Was it the KBO that did that with the cardboard cutouts?
They did like mannequins and stuff, right?
I mean, yeah, that's bizarre.
And that's really weird.
If you want to do CGI to kind of the television broadcast to not make it look so weird, I get that. But the in-person stuff, that's strange.
I think it's okay just as long as they aren't ugly people being displayed. Just put a bunch of pretty-looking people up there.
But it's all three-dimensional. It's totally weird, Kevin. It's like you look up and that guy, did that guy move? I think that guy's nodded his head. Just freak me out.
And these are not cardboard cutouts that are going to be able to get out of the way of a foul ball, you know?
Wasn't there an incredibly horrible movie called Mannequin where somebody came to life as a mannequin? I think
Michael Keaton? Is that Michael Keaton?
I don't know who it was. I think it was
Andrew McCarthy.
Andrew McCarthy.
Yeah, 87. Oh,
terrible, terrible actor.
Really bad.
Yeah, he was in the worst movie ever made.
Why was I thinking Michael Keaton?
St. Elmo's Fire. I don't know where you're going with Michael Keaton.
To be fair, though, he was also in the best movie ever made, Weekend at Bernie's. So we have to look at both sides of the equation.
You know, in fairness to me, Michael Keaton was a little stiff in Batman.
Oh, boy, that's just mean. That's mean-spirited. Michael Keaton is one of our national treasures, and he's from, like, Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania, some area, where he still hangs out with his high school friends. He's like a normal dude. Have you ever heard that about him?
I have not, and I think he's very talented. And he is returning to play Batman once again, I think. So we
know.
Yes, I think he is.
Are you kidding? What are they going to do? Like Batman at 70?
I don't know. I think he's definitely in talks. I think I read that story somewhere.
Wow, that's
maybe there's a Mr. Mom sequel in his future as well. I don't know.
You know, do not badmouth Mr. Mom. That is like that the funniest scene in that movie is when he has got the same sweatshirt on through the whole movie, and then he has this thing where he's attacked or he's shot, some dream, and he looks down as he's bleeding out, and he says, "I love this sweatshirt." I like fell over when I heard that line the first time. I just thought it was so stupid.
One of
Terry Hatcher, a young Terry Hatcher.
She was in that, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, Michael Keaton's best. We could go all day on Michael Keaton roles. I mean,
he's been in everything. He's been in everything. Yeah.
He's not... McDonald's movie, right?
He was. That's right. Yeah. Yes. He played Ray Kroc.
Ray Kroc?
Yeah.
Spotlight? Oh, my gosh. Spotlight. Come on, Molly. You have to love Spotlight.
Oh, that's a great movie. Yeah, that's a journalist movie and a Catholic church scandal movie. There's so many things about that that I love. What was the other movie he was in? Did he win an Oscar for Birdman? Is that
Beetlejuice?
Right? Beetlejuice. Jeez, okay. Now we're doing 7 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. I mean, Michael Keaton apparently has been in every movie made.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. David, I'm delighted to hear that they're making movies again. I thought, didn't I read something that like all these television series, everything that you're watching is going to come to an abrupt end at some point? There's not going to be able to release anything new because nobody's made any movies in a while?
Well, that's the problem with movies. That's going to be the problem with television series. It's going to be very strange. Mm-hmm. You know, it's will you go to a movie? Will you feel any trepidation about walking into a movie theater, sitting down in a seat that somebody else sat in just previously, and getting some popcorn? I don't know.
A year ago on Tuesday, we were at a drive-in because I got one of those memory things from my phone. Hey, in case you forgot what you did a year ago, here's where you were.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an impressive recall.
Yeah, I was like, wow. But I think that was the first time and only time our kids have been to a drive-in.
You know,
and
what?
It was kind of remarkable.
Drive-ins are cool. And a year ago yesterday, I cleaned out my garage.
Oh, did you get the memory? The
yeah,
photos?
I got the memory. Yeah.
All right, we're going to get to the 5 and 5. It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 to the score.
It's 5 and 5 with Mully and Haw, where we debate the top 5 sports stories of the day and then open it up to you, the Chicago sports fan. Call us at 312-644-6767, or you can tweet your thoughts at Mully Haw. 5 and 5 with Mully and Haw starts now.
Cubs and White Sox are both among teams petitioning to have live, albeit reduced, crowds at games. If you could go to a game with about 8,000 people in the stands, would you do it? Would you be willing to pay more than face value for a ticket? If yes, would you pay double, triple, or more?
I'm all over it. I would definitely do it, and I am excited at the idea of it, to be honest with you. I think it'd be a lot of fun. I would be more than happy to pay for my ticket. I probably would go up to paying double because it's been so long since I've had a chance to go to a game, and presumably I'd be at a Cubs Sox game on either side of town. So yeah, I would happily do it, and I would pay double. I don't think I'd pay more than that. And again, you know, there's my tickets, there's 5 of us. So I would go with the crew and would want to sit just with the 5 of us, with nobody in a row ahead of us or behind us or whatever. I'd be delighted to do that, and I would pay probably up to double the price of those tickets just for the one-off of getting to a game. I don't think I would pay much more than that, and I would prefer not to have to pay twice the price, but I feel a certain desperation to get out and to be in the outdoors and to watch baseball. I think that it would be a transportive experience, and I would love to do that. Absolutely love to do it.
I am curious to see how eager people are to gather in large groups like that. I guess if we're seeing anything based on, you know, their people's willingness or eagerness to get to the bar scene or to go, you know, socialize or go dine out, maybe that is naive. Maybe people are going to be, you know, flocking in the supply and demand. There's going to be a lot more demand than is supply, so maybe the price of the secondary market will be, you know, pretty lucrative for people. I don't know that I'm in such a rush to do that. I think I like the television product. I like the radio product. I don't know that I would pay necessarily double for a regular season game. If either team makes the playoffs, that's a different story. I mean, then you kind of want to be there. By then, it will be, you know, down the road a little bit and early October. I think as we sit here at the end of June, there's not that much that sounds appealing to me to sitting around 8,000 strangers in the midst of having to go through what you'd have to go through to get there. It would be great to sit there and watch baseball. Everybody wants that. Everybody wants to feel like a typical summer day again, but I don't know that I would be in a huge rush to pay more than face value to go out and experience a game at Wrigley or at Guaranteed Rate Field. Now, if you're working, it's a different story. If you're going from a fan, I think let's wait and see. I'd say, you want to go? Okay, you guys take my ticket. I'm good.
Well, my first thought when hearing that teams were going to try to let in fans into the crowd just made me think back again to the labor strife and the owners crying poor, saying, oh, well, we're not going to be able to have anybody in the stadiums all season long. We're going to be losing all this money. And here we just turn around about a week later and all of a sudden 8,000 people are going to be allowed to file into your stadium and buy hot dogs and nachos and $12 beers and what have you. So just another reason to hate the owners, first and foremost. That's where my mind goes immediately. But I would consider going to a game. I think I feel more comfortable being, you know, if I have to be around people, I feel more comfortable being outdoors. Obviously, you would have to take a million different safety precautions and protocols and make people feel as comfortable as possible. Have people wear masks, obviously, when they're not eating or drinking something. Take people's temperature upon entering the stadium. Socially distance fans far away from one another. Mully, like you said, if you're going with your family, it'll be you five, perhaps, you know, in one row, and then the other, some other fans, maybe two or three rows away from you, if not more. You know, if we're only doing 8,000 fans, these are, you know, vast, vast stadiums. You're going to be able to spread people out and regulate how many people are allowed, you know, in, even in a bathroom at one time or what have you. So I would definitely consider it if I saw all of the precautions and things that were going to be followed to get people inside. Financially, would I pay face value for a ticket? I'd pay face. I don't know if I would pay more than face. I don't know if I'd pay double or triple. That's just me personally. I don't exactly have that kind of disposable income at the moment. That's more of a personal problem. But if I had it, then I would definitely consider it.
At the moment, I'm going to say no, I wouldn't go to a game with 8,000 people in the stands. But what I would do is if and when we start seeing fans being, you know, let into games, I'd like to see how it plays out. I'd like to see if people are acting responsibly. I'd like to see if people are following the rules, because day to day, we don't see people following the damn rules. So I don't know how it's going to work at a game when people have some beers in them and things like that. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm being pessimistic, and maybe people will act right and follow the rules. And if everything looks like it's going well when we do have fans and stands at baseball games, I'd consider going. But at the moment, it's a no, and I would not pay more than face value for a ticket.
Well, I like going to Cubs games just about as much as anybody I know. I'm kind of shocked by the answers on this panel so far. Ray brings up, everybody's brought up some really good points and reasons why to go and not to go. My kids were dying to go sit outside at a restaurant, not inside. That's not legal until I think today, but they wanted to sit outside at a restaurant, not like at a bar, like a real restaurant. And we did, but the whole time, like to what Ray's point, like, is everybody following the rules? You know, who looks dirty, who washed their hands, who's not wearing the face mask properly, like, right? Oh. Who's the jerk, right? Like, they've got their mouth covered but not their nose covered, or they've got it like hanging off their ear. You see where I'm going with this, Molly, right? So yeah. It's like, now it's a distraction. I'm with you. Like you said, your crew would like to go take up a row of five. And if you had two rows in front of you open and two rows behind you open, you feel, and you're outside, you feel safe. I just feel like I would be looking for all these, as Ray put it, people not following the rules. And I wouldn't be watching the game then. And that would, the food I ate at the restaurant was fine, but the waitress was almost like nervous. Like she's putting out the calamari at the table and it was like in her hand. And it was like, okay, like a kid going into a pool. 1, 2, 3, here's your calamari. Like, and then like jump back. Like it's just, it's not the same. And I saw somebody on Twitter yesterday and I thought it was a really great point. And if you've got kids going back to school, supposedly, in the fall, and you got kids going to college, and there's these nerves, you know, stage 3 compared to stage 0 and 1 and 2 is very livable and enjoyable. And I don't know that I'm ready to dive into stage four. And could we just stay, like, I think the progression from stage three to stage four is a little too quick for me personally. But I love Wrigley Field. I even like going, believe it or not, to 35th and Shields. I
it's
love
a lot nicer
the
and the food's
experience.
Better, so that makes sense.
The food used to be way better at 35th and Shields. It's still better, but I think the gap has closed. I'm not going to take my typical shot about attendance right now, but I have mixed feelings about it. I just feel like I don't think I personally would enjoy the experience because I'd be looking for the non-conformist, the non-rule followers, and they'd be like, all right, let's go. Let's wrap it up. Let's get out of here.
Can I clarify my position? When I envision this, it's the five of us in the stands. I think we've arrived slightly late, so there's no crowd. Nobody is using a restroom. Nobody is eating any food of any type in my mind. Do you understand what I'm saying? We're not spending a dime other than the tickets, and we're getting the hell out of there if you have to go to the Luigi.
What happens to the extra innings? Are you like, help that guy from second score so I could take a leak?
I think we're long gone if somebody really has to go because we're not doing it.
It's a tough one, Bruce. It's a very fair question and obviously a ripe one.
Asked about the legitimacy of a 60-game season, Rick Hahn said during his teleconference Thursday, is it a legitimate season? Absolutely. Do you agree? Do you think Hahn has to say that, or does he believe it? What do you think the majority of baseball executives, coaches, and players believe?
Well, I think they believe that the championship, that when you have a World Series celebration, that will be legitimate. That will be the celebration of a season that is unlike any other anyone's experienced. And I think to get to that point, yeah, you can look back and history might record this as with an asterisk because of the conditions, because of the 60 games, because of a lot of reasons. But I do feel like there's the competitive spirit, those things that come out in over the course of a 60-game season are very natural, very instinctive. Yeah, it's going to be legitimate. Yeah, you have to look at it that way. I'm glad he said that because there's going to be a feeling of that this is going to be different. And we talked about the extra innings changes and what's going to happen. And there's going to be a gimmicky feel to some of this. And there are different rules and there's different schedules and there's different structure to the divisions. All of those things are true. Still baseball. It's still going to be a winner. There's still going to be a champion. And you're still going to feel like you accomplished something meaningful. And I think the longer it goes on, you know, it's a different scenario because they played more of the season, but the 2013 Blackhawks never had to apologize for winning the Stanley Cup in a season that was very truncated, and I love that word. But I think so that the World Series champion in baseball in 2020 is going to be facing the same sort of oddity historically, but I don't think they have to apologize for anything. It is definitely a legitimate season. I just can't wait for it to start.
Yeah, I think when you're asking a general manager about the legitimacy of the season, you're talking about, and he's talking about, the competition between the two teams. And it will be legitimate competition. In other words, everyone will be trying to win. And he's probably as desperate to see the team he's put together play as people who have watched him put the team together is desperate to see them play. So I think that is the answer. When you're talking about the entirety of a 162-game season that's pared down to 60 games, I don't know about the legitimacy of that. I don't know. I do believe that when you get into the playoffs, there will be even more competition, if that is humanly possible. But that's not about the legitimacy of this season compared to past seasons. And I think that is maybe what the question was looking for, and the answer is more about how you're going to play it and what you're going to do. And I think most people are desperate to get to it, and that's baseball coaches and executives and players. I think they want to play the game, and they believe in the spirit of that competition. But I think when we look back on the entirety of the thing, yeah, we'll throw an asterisk right up there, unless, of course, the Chicago team wins.
Sure, yeah, that would be an exception, certainly. Then it's the most legitimate thing we've ever seen. But, I mean, what is Rick Hahn supposed to say? No, this is totally illegitimate. This is BS. I don't know why we're playing. Nobody's going to take this seriously. Who gives a damn? Of course he's going to say it's legitimate. And I think that the players and the coaching staffs and And all the executives probably have to have that same mentality. If they don't believe that it's a legitimate season with a legitimate result, then what are they really doing out there? You know, they're kind of wasting everybody's time. So I think that you have to be in that right mindset, and I think that's part of the mental preparation for this season is for the players specifically, you know, getting in that state of mind saying, all right, you know, it's a short season. It's a little weird. It's going to be no fans or a very small amount of fans, and the divisions will be a little bit different, and it's 60 games and 66 days and all of these other weird things about the season. As a player, you're going to have to concede all of that stuff and just accept it and get in that right mindset to compete and take these games as seriously as you would in any other quote-unquote normal season. So I think that that's going to be a big part of mentally preparing for the players, unlike any other season. You know, I'm sure back in March during regular spring training 1.0, if you want to call it that, that all the players were getting in that right mindset, you know, like it was a normal season. Now you're going to have to adjust it a little bit, and I think guys are going to be able to do that, and I think the players will absolutely take it 100% seriously and be fighting and grinding to win every single game like they would any other year.
I agree with Rick Hahn. Yes, this is a legitimate season, and I agree because we're fortunate to even be having the discussion about the return of baseball because we're in the middle of a pandemic. And, you know, that we've seen a multi-level botching of the handling of this pandemic in this country. But, hey, I'll stick to sports and get back to the question. I think a majority of coaches and players and executives do believe that this is a legitimate season. They're going to operate as such, and there's going to be every team hoping to take advantage of this shortened season and win a championship. So I think the only place you may see some questions over the legitimacy of the season maybe will be some of these owners that didn't want a season to happen, a handful of them. But in terms of the people on the day-to-day grind, I think they're taking this seriously.
Rick Hahn, answered absolutely. I will absolutely agree with what Rick said. I do absolutely believe that he believes it, and I absolutely believe that executives, coaches, and players believe it as well. Now, you might ask the teams that don't make the postseason in 3 months if they think that way, but I think right now everybody's in it to win it.
What was the other question you asked me?
Rick Renteria sounded open to the idea of using an opener to pitch the first couple innings, as well as trying to use two starters and a piggyback approach to pitching games. What approach is the smartest for the Sox rotation, and how many starters on the Sox do you trust? Who's the best choice for the opener?
Look, we've just gotten going here. I trust everyone. There's not a shadow of doubt in my mind that they've got about 7 or 8 starters that could get the job done. That's because the season hasn't been played. So as we go into this thing and as we work our way through it, I'm probably going to feel a lot differently about who's to be trusted and who isn't. Lucas Giolito is the opening day starter, and he is your starter, and you feel good about having him as the opener on opening day and the opener. And I think you feel good about a few different people in the rotation. You know, personally, I feel real good about Lucas Giolito. I think Dallas Keuchel is a total pro. I think he's going to be a fine starter. I think that, or opener, whatever way you want to term it. I think that Michael Kopech, I trust as an opener. I trust Dylan Cease as an opener. I even, at this point, trust Ronaldo Lopez until he proves differently as an opener. We haven't even talked about Gio Gonzalez. What a great opener he is. And my God, is Dane Dunne going to be one hell of an opener when finally we get to see him. Is Carlos Rodon back? He would certainly be a candidate to be an opener since he used to be a starter. So I'm not kidding you. I right now am a big believer in everything until it is disproven. So if Ronaldo's going to start struggling right away, I'll quickly lose faith in him. But at this point, I believe in all of them.
I count 7 starters that I trust with the White Sox, and I think that's a long list. But I think until they have, you know, proven unworthy of that trust, it's defensible. You look everywhere. I'm including Rodon. I'm including Gio Gonzalez on that list because the Sox have a lot of depth. They have an embarrassment of riches if everyone stays healthy. So they have a lot of options. I was curious to see if Ricky Renteria would address the whole idea of an opener, which traditionally is a reliever in that role. And you bring in a guy like, you know, maybe Steve Cishek is your opener, and you want to set up for whatever reason, you know, that kind of pattern. I'm not sure what they would get out of that. I think he's just going to have to look at a lot of different possibilities, depending on health, depending on how good of shape guys report back in, where their arms are. So there are a lot of things to factor in. Who's the best choice for opener? I do like Cishek. Cishek is like that pair of khaki pants you got in your drawer. I mean, they go every use you can think of, every possibility. It goes with everything. Steve Cishek, the khaki pants of the Sox pitching staff. He is the guy that I would turn to if you were looking at a reliever. But as far as starters, I don't know if you need to get to that point necessarily because you have so many other options. I like the piggyback approach. I like Rodon starting and Lopez cleaning up, or vice versa, because Rodon, to me, is the most intriguing piece of this puzzle, because if he's healthy, if he's capable of helping, then and he's on, let's remember what he can be, what he possibly, what the ceiling is for Carlos Rodon if healthy. That's exciting, and the White Sox pitching is going to be their strength.
I think that maybe a piggyback approach would be better than the opener that we've seen, Tampa Bay and some other teams utilize over the past couple seasons, where it would be a bullpen guy starting and just, you know, pitching maybe just one or two innings and then making way for the next guy. I think, a piggyback approach with seven, potentially eight starters would be a great idea, as you guys brought up. You know, you throw Michael Kopech out there to start the game. He goes three or four innings, and then, yeah, maybe it's Lopez, maybe it's Dylan Cease, maybe it is Rodon, maybe it's Dunning, if he's healthy, and they come close it out for the final three frames of the game. I think that's a great idea with all the depth and, the mindfulness to preserve some of these young arms. You know, I want to see Michael Kopech pitch as much as possible, but I'm sure if he gets up there to 80, 85 pitches, you're going to be making the call to the bullpen. So I do like the depth that they have in terms of the starting rotation. If they're going to go with a bullpen guy to start the game, I don't know if I'd use Cishek. I'd probably want to save Cishek, Bummer, and Colome for 7th, 8th, 9th inning, high leverage if there are guys on base. If you're going to start the game off with a reliever in a clean inning, I'd probably go with somebody like Evan Marshall or Jimmy Cordero, who both had pretty good seasons last year. But I like the depth of the Sox pitching staff for sure. There's a ton of variables here, high ceiling, low floor potentially. But if all of these guys can reach their potential and stay healthy and remain consistent throughout this short season, I think it's going to give the White Sox a huge, huge boon in whatever divisional alignment they end up in.
I think this is the season of experimentation. I wouldn't mind seeing the Sox try out an opener or try the piggyback approach and see which works best for them. I think both of those are smart ways to go about it, and then just see which one works best. How many starters do you trust? You know, if you're going like David and saying there's seven, if you want to put Rodon and Kopech on that list, the only one on the list of the starting rotation I'm unsure of is Ronaldo Lopez, because he's of his up and down season last year. But hopefully he turns things around. So I'm going to at least say six of the there's six pitchers you can have some confidence in. The best choice for the opener, Mully, I'm like you. I think Cease would be potentially a good idea. Kopech would be a good idea. I think those are the two guys you want to consider.
Well, with all due respect to Ricky Renteria, who seems like a very, 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 very nice person, I want to hear what Coop thinks of these ideas. I guess Ricky at the end of the day is going to make the final decision if things are set up properly, but I really want to hear what Coop has to say about this, because the I think there's some confusion to the term. I don't know if we're crystal clear. Is this, and Molly's right, I mean, if it's who's to start the first game of the season, then it's Lucas Giolito by a landslide. I think the Sox are set up better in the field and hitting than necessarily pitching overall. They do have an abundance of starting pitching, but you know, I want to be glass half full. So I'm going to go with Mully and just say, I believe in all of it until we see that all of it isn't working right. But I'd much rather hear from Coop on the pitching than Ricky Renteria.
I don't quite get the question.
Until Merritt Lightfoot eases local restrictions, fans cannot attend Cubs or White Sox games in person, but Crane Kenny said on The Score yesterday that the rooftops will be open for games at Wrigley Field. Do you think people will flock to the rooftops to watch? Would you? And could that help provide any type of home field advantage for the Cubs?
If you can't get into Wrigley Field, people are going to want to go to the rooftops. They're going to want to get as close as possible. I think those seats and those that experience will be in high demand. So, yeah, I do believe that people will flock there if they can't get into the stadium and the ballpark. I don't know that I would be in a rush, as we've discussed earlier. I do think it will, if not a home field advantage, it will do as much as possible to make players feel comfortable and do what the Cubs are trying to do and duplicate the normal experience and to normalize things like they will when they play, you know, the walk-up music and have the virtual seventh inning stretch and they have a DJ and all sorts of things that they have thought of to try to make, you know, these players feel like they are in a typical atmosphere, even though there won't be anything typical about it. And they'll have the PA announcer and everything. So the rooftop fans watching as close as they can possibly get, yeah, that kind of contributes and enhances that experience. I'm not sure if it's a home field advantage at all, but it will be a nice touch. And I do think that it's something that the Cubs, or at least the people who own those rooftops, they're going to take advantage of.
No interest in going to a rooftop for me. I have been to the rooftops. I have enjoyed myself there. I have also found it, you know, I was at the rooftops before they became these clubs that they are now, right? It's like going into a skybox, and then you get to go outside and sit up in some bleacher-type seating. And, you know, it's a lot of food and a lot of drink. And I've said this before, I'm maybe bringing a little sandwich with me, but that would be it. And I am not. Definitely not going to drink anything because that brings in the horror of using facilities. So I would not want to go into the rooftop. It's privately owned. Is there a limit on how many people are in the rooftop? These are pretty enclosed spaces, some of them, and the idea of like kind of even walking through the house to get to the bleachers is a little bit disconcerting to me. I just don't know that's something that I would be willing to do. You know, will it provide some atmosphere? And you know, I could see it getting to a point where players are waving up to the rooftops and you know, you have to do a bow to the rooftop. I mean, I think it would be a huge thing for people, for the Cubs to get that sort of support. And I think it would help engage the players in the game. And I think that it would give them more of a home field advantage than other teams enjoy. But, you know, I got to tell you, it's just not something that I would be interested in doing at this point without a medical treatment or vaccine.
You know, anytime I see the phrase Crane Kenny said, I start to get a little bit skeptical. So I guess I'll believe it when I see it. But when there are, and if and when that there are rooftops open and available for fans, I think people will absolutely flock to them. I mean, people are trying to flock anywhere and at any time right now just because everybody's got so much cabin fever. And again, you know, being outdoors, you know, me personally, I do feel a little bit safer than if I'm going to Walgreens or the grocery store or anything like that. For whatever reason, maybe it's just me and my mental, but if I feel like I'm outside, I feel more safe than usual. I personally probably would not go to a rooftop. It's kind of a novelty. You do it a couple times and then you're kind of over it. You're so far away from the field itself, and it's so totally, you know, not like being at the game at all. You know, I make fun of Wrigley. It's old and it's stinky and all of these other things, which are all true. But I do enjoy going to Cub games very much, and I enjoy being at Wrigley Field. It's not really the same experience, though, on a rooftop. You do it a couple times, and you don't really have the desire to do it again. So I would probably hold off on the rooftop unless I got a free ticket or something like that.
Yes, people will flock to rooftops, as Kevin just said. Everybody's looking for something to do. So, yes, would I? I'd be a little more apt to go to a rooftop than a game just because of the smaller capacity on that rooftop. If, you know, I'd like to know if there's going to be the social distancing measures put in place and all of that. So I would kind of be interested in it. But the thing is, then you have to leave early, because if you don't leave early before the game is over, then you're just going to be in a big crowd. I take the CTA, I'd be up on a crowded red line, and that's kind of defeats the whole purpose of social distancing. So I may as well just listen to the game on the score or stay home, watch it on TV.
Do you have the Marquee Network?
I don't have the Marquee Network because, like David Haw, I have Comcast, so no Marquee yet.
Well, Crane says it's coming.
It's coming.
Yeah, Crane
said
it.
That one I'll believe when I see. Would it provide a home field advantage? Ian Happ told our sister station WBBM it would, so I'm with Happy. I think it will provide a slight advantage.
I don't know why we're questioning if Crane said it. Is it really true? I don't know.
No, we're not. I am.
Well, okay, you guys can't.
That's the point of the segment, right? We all have our own five different opinions.
No one else said that.
There are two parties involved in the Marquee thing. So
again, the thoughts of Kevin Cipak do not necessarily reflect the views of the Mullion Haw Show or 670 The Score.
Okay, I there's no reason to believe that the rooftops wouldn't be open. Now, my question with the rooftops would be, will the money generated from the rooftops go right back into Cubs baseball? That's something that we could ask. And
now it's election season.
I would not rush, but I do like the experience of the rooftop. It's fun. It's different. If you do like to, as Mully put it, if you do like to get your beverage and food on, there is really nothing better than that. If I pay $100 or $125 for a rooftop on a single, I'm going to get my food and beverage worth. I'm going to eat that and drink that probably two times over if I was in the stadium. I've gone to those things and eaten five sandwiches in the sitting. So I'm going to get my money's worth. If you haven't gone, go. You know, you might have a better idea of who you're with when you go than you would in the stadium, to Ray's point. There's a smaller crowd. So if it's available to you, go. I don't know that I this year would be rushing to it, but next year, when I hope things are much more like 2019, I'll be right there hoping to get up on top of one of those rooftops.
That is an unbelievably great question.
According to research by Joel Sherman of the New York Post, on June 4th, 2019, when 19 of MLB's 30 teams had played 60 games, they had used 625 pitchers, including field players, with 242 starters. Will major league teams need 8 different starters among 20 different pitchers during this season? Without a proper training camp and the possibility of COVID-19 infection, will the number be even higher?
Well, I think the number will be higher for those reasons. Last I checked, it's 3 weeks of training camp, and you're going to need a lot of pitching. That's why the rosters start at 30 and work their way down, because of pitching. You've got to be able to give guys time to work their way into a season. You don't want to overburden different players. And it's actually part of a much larger, maybe more fascinating conversation, whether you should try to use guys as much as you can early, get a big head start, and then maybe rest and lay off a little bit toward the end of the season. It's such a quick snapshot that we're looking at here. But, yeah, I mean, look, the field position players, all that nonsense is why you got to 20 different players. But my goodness gracious, it is really something to be concerned about, the number of pitchers that you're going to need. So I would imagine that it's going to be more than what happened a year ago, just because of the circumstances.
I thought there would be no math. I think it's interesting research. I have to think that I want to give the pitching coaches and the organizations the benefit of the doubt here. We heard it yesterday a little bit from the White Sox. I think there could be an unconventional way of viewing
starting pitching, of viewing your entire pitching staff. Maybe starters are thought to be four-inning guys. Maybe the playoff approach in where you don't look at guys, you know, five and six innings even, that maybe will help preserve some of these arms and give you a different sort of dynamic that was in place at the beginning of last season when you were kind of planning for 162. And maybe that will help kind of mitigate some of these problems, and maybe not. But I hope so, because you're right. There's going to be a lot of things you can't envision, a lot of things you can't project. What if somebody has a positive test and has to be quarantined for 2 weeks? That's going to be, you do without, and that's going to hurt your pitching staff. So you're going to need as many as possible. But I don't know about loading up early. I think you want to plan for, be cautious here, and maybe don't push anyone beyond their limits until you absolutely have to. And maybe that's mid-September before that arrives. But, yeah, these are fascinating numbers that probably deserve a deeper look.
You know, guys are always going to get hurt. That's a given. There will be positive tests, so guys are going to have to miss time for that as well. And I think that, this is something you guys brought up yesterday, the urgency of the season. Players aren't going to have enough rope. If Dylan C starts three games in a row and he gets shelled, I don't know if you're going to see him starting a fourth game, and maybe they're going to try somebody else in that spot. You're going to have less patience with players who aren't performing well to just kind of break out of it or find themselves, and that's going to lead to more player turnover as well. So I think the number of pitchers used this season is going to be very, very high.
I agree. It's the fact that training camp is so screwed up because of the circumstances that you will see more pitches than the pitchers used than the numbers dug up by Joel Sherman from a year ago. You need to make some, I think teams are going to need to make deep starting rotations. Yeah, eight sounds like a good number. There's going to be more pitchers used.
Well, going back to the first question, I think we talked about players being in it to win it. This is where we're going to find out. If you're a guy that's really ticked off by what's going on and you run down to first base and, ooh, my hamstring, ooh, my Achilles, ooh, my buttocks, something hurts, ooh, I'm a pitcher, ooh, shoulder tightness, you need to sit down. I think the numbers are going to be way, 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 way up. And if this isn't the proper training camp, if this isn't enough time to get ready, then can we just have baseball start next week? Why do we have to wait till the 24th if that's not enough time? So come on, which one is it? They've already had a spring training. What have they been doing, sitting around playing Xbox for the last 3.5 months? Let's go. Pick up the ball, throw it to the catcher, play ball.
312-644-6767 is the number. It's Mully and Haw. It's Chicago Sports Radio, 6-7 of the score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.